Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the ongoing evolution of our awakening, our individual, planetary, cultural. We are now in a time of transition, as anyone could see by just looking around them. I mean, the old institutions are falling apart, and the new structures are being formed, and we need direction. We need to know, or need to at least have a sense of these new times. And that's one of the reasons I'm talking to tonight's guest, Kevin Sachs, PhD. And just to introduce him, Kevin's been on a spiritual path for over 40 years. He has a professional practice in New York City as a holistic and experimental spiritual counselor. He offers ongoing personal, spiritual, and emotional support for people who are doing spiritual practices and are working with difficult emotions and shadow material and are attempting to integrate a deeper transformational inner experience. He facilitates and supports and educates people about the transformational process of all kinds. And we'll talk more about his individual sessions. He's available for personal readings. Anyway, Kevin, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me, Alan. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
Yes, and I think your work is very key to what I'm talking about as far as new realities, which is, well, you work very personally in helping people transform their lives into new realities. But I just want to say Kevin will be on at a panel discussion on the panel May 16th, 2013 with Trish McCann and Steve Lawrence about the transformation in the digital age. So I just wanted to put that, and that's going to be at the Meta Center. You can go to my website, newrealities.com, to look for specific times and locations for that. What stands out as I read your introduction and talk to you is the idea of the shadow material. I mean, the shadow, and you can talk about what that means, but that's generally a place people don't like to go near. They try to avoid it, and you dive right into that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, one of the things that I've discovered throughout my life, throughout the work I've done on myself as well as work with other people, is that as we delve deeper into ourselves, as we delve deeper in our spiritual evolution and our spiritual journeys, we're bound to hit the shadow. It's a necessary thing. It's an inevitable thing.
Well, can you define the shadow before I'm just
yeah. So what I mean when I talk about shadow is that there are aspects of ourselves that are extremely painful for us to face, extremely painful for us to experience. And we learn very early on that somehow these aspects of who we are unacceptable to us. And what we do is we banish them to some part of our soul or our psyche that we just can't see at all.
But can you – I just want to interrupt. Sorry. But just yeah. One, when you say the parts, what would like, for instance, you know, you can – don't have to use a person, but what would be a part that someone wouldn't want to see about themselves?
Sure. Now, what's interesting about the shadow, by the way, is that those things that we banish are not only the darkest parts of ourselves, but also often the parts of ourselves that have the most light. But I'll give you an example from my own work on myself of shadow, of very profound shadow experience I had, and hopefully that will give you some idea of what I'm talking about. It was on a deep shamanic journey that I did several years ago. And in the course of this journey, I found myself in a Nazi concentration camp. And it was very dark and it was very unpleasant to be there. I mean, unpleasant doesn't even begin to describe how it felt. And as I moved deeper and deeper into this journey, I was actually horrified to find that I wasn't an inmate in this concentration camp, but that I was actually one of the guards.
Wow. I was an inmate in one of those in my past life, but anyway, we'll talk about mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. So what was interesting about this experience, I mean, it was I literally spent several hours in this state of consciousness, wrestling with this reality of having this intensity of evil inside of me. It was unacceptable to me, and I would have done anything at that point in time to make this go away, to really not have to experience that this was a part of who I am. And of course, as spiritual beings, we include everything within ourselves, the entire spectrum from the greatest good to the greatest evil. And so it's all there. And, you know, the interesting thing for me was that after this experience had passed, I found that I had changed in a couple of different ways. One was, it was really hard for me to get involved in conversations with people when they would say that this particular character was evil or that particular character was evil, depending on their own perspectives, because I kind of felt, well, you know, after what I've seen in myself, I can't be pointing the finger at somebody else. But the other effect that this experience had on me was not even – the most important part for me wasn't even so much seeing that I had this very dark part of myself. It was seeing the lengths to which I was willing to go to not experience it.
Well, how were you able to actually – I mean, what did you say? You sort of said it was unacceptable. How was it eventually acceptable? How did you integrate that?
Well, ultimately, I had to spend time with it. It wasn't going to go away. I had to spend time with it. I did that in the context of that particular journey that I was on, but I've also done it really in very gentle and gradual ways since. And what I've learned is that the more I can accept that in myself, and it's not easy. It really is not an easy thing, so I don't mean to make it sound as if this is easy. It's extremely difficult, and I still tend to want to run away from that experience. But to the extent that I can live with it, to the extent that I can hold it, what I find is that the world around me is somehow a little more stable, a little more peaceful, a little less dark. You know, what I realized is I learned a lot about what Jung, who's the original Westerner who introduced this notion of shadow, what he called projection, because what he claimed we did is that when we banish these dark parts of ourselves kind of out of our sight and into the shadows, we would project it onto other people or other things or other institutions. And the big realization for me from that experience was, how many people are there in the world? Several billion people. And if every one of them is trying as hard as I was to banish this darkness in themselves, then what must we be creating in this world out there? And that's what I learned. What I learned is we all dream this world together. We all create this world together. And unfortunately, but my experience of the reality is that the vast amount of our mental energy that's used creating our world around us is the mental energy from the parts of ourselves that we don't look at. And so what happens is a lot of what's in the world around us that we don't like is really our disowned selves being projected on the screen in front of us in a very collective way.
Right. Jung also said that part that we do banish or ignore will come back to us. We'll create, we'll manifest it in our reality. If we have a judgment about somebody being a certain way, it will show up right in our face.
That's absolutely right. And you know, one of the ways that people work with shadow material is by looking at what bothers them in other people, because that's usually a good clue to what it is about ourselves that we don't want to look at.
But could you get, when you were, you know, in that place of contemplating being a Nazi in these camps, could you get into the psychology of that person or that part of yourself and understand? I wouldn't say evil, but I would say, because I don't think anything is really evil or not, but could you understand where that was coming from and of course get a fuller picture of humanity, but could you understand that part?
The understanding that I had wasn't analytical in that sort of way, in kind of understanding the psychology of evil. Although I might have had such an experience in another situation, but I think that what I really learned to do was accept that that archetype is just, it's a part of this whole that we all carry around. And there's no judgment about it. It's if you think of the one intelligence that is all, that is everything in this universe, that creates this universe at every moment, of course it has to have everything. And the idea is, what I've learned is that my spirituality is about learning to be a container that can hold this entire spectrum of who I am and of who we are. And, of course, that exists at a personal level, but also kind of a universal level.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I just had a question about that because, I mean, that dark side exists, but it's not – I mean, I don't think you're saying it's okay to be okay with it and not try to change that even though it exists. I mean, of course, we can't ignore if it's in ourselves, but if it's in the world – and something in a way is unacceptable or unacceptable behavior, it's not about, I think, putting up with that. I mean, that's the part I'm a little confused about. So you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think – mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I think I do. We all have different roles in this world. And, of course, you know, it's a beautiful thing to fight for what's good and to fight against what's evil. And so I'm not in any way, you know, negating the efforts that people make, the beautiful efforts that people to make this world, you know, a wonderful and beautiful place. But what I'm suggesting is that at a deeper level, if we could all hold the full spectrum of who we are, we would become more fully and truly ourselves. And that includes being able to hold the darkest parts of ourselves. And as I said before, I don't want to give short shrift to the fact that, you know, shadow material is also positive. You know, the for instance, when we fall in love, very often that has to do with our inability to accept the beauty and love in ourselves and projecting it onto other people. And so, you know, there's light and dark shadow. Shadow is really anything that we don't hold in our consciousness. So what I'm advocating or what I'm saying is that the more people are willing to embody all that's inside of them, to really hold it all, to really accept it all, what happens is evil in the world, I think, will lessen. Because the evil in the world is the projection of what we won't look at in ourselves.
Right.
So we'll stop projecting if we can hold it.
I think you're also saying we will be more sympathetic to it. Instead of saying this person's evil and that's it and you do away with them, there's a deeper level of connection, realization about who people are, and I don't think anyone's purely evil or purely good. I think we're all a mix of everything, but you're saying if we can accept those parts of ourselves that aren't so pretty, then we have an easier time with ourselves and an easier time with other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Alan, and I think that was in many ways the ultimate lesson of my experience, which is that, you know, you asked how I integrated this, and I think ultimately the question is how I integrated it was that I had to become compassionate towards myself. And I think in many ways self-compassion is what leads to compassion for others. At least that's the way it's worked for me. Being able to really hold all the parts of myself that I don't like, that I've spent so much effort and so much energy and so much time rejecting, to be able to hold it and then just really look at myself with compassion, you know, as a human being who's had all these experiences, who's been, you know, through whatever I've been through, and here it all is. And we all do what we do, you know, to kind of to move forward. We're all moving forward towards our own wholeness, and we do it in ways that we do it, and we have to hold that with compassion. I agree with you completely, Alan.
No, I think that's a huge step, and it's a huge understanding in some of someone's own self when they can come from that place and accept themselves. This is who I am, and of course, we want to change, but I got something there. That just by accepting yourself, it is already part of that integration. I get that, and I think that's a big piece for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's one of the hardest things that I've had to do in my own spiritual work is that self-acceptance. I think it's really key, though, and I think the more that we can really accept ourselves, the more we grow spiritually, the more we awaken to the greatness that's in us. It's like paradoxical. It's like once we accept the parts of us that we haven't liked very much, that's when we start to become more aware of the vast treasures that exist inside of us.
Well, you know, it also makes spirituality real and practical. A lot of people think of spirituality as woo-woo out there, light, fairies, meditation. But I don't think that's real spirituality. That's an avoidance of what you're saying, which feels much more grounded in truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was certainly a big realization for me. I mean, I used to be one of those people, you know. I used to really, to me, the spiritual path was this kind of mildly inclined, you know, walking up a sunny hill to, you know, the peak of a mountain, and it's all glorious. But my own path hasn't been that way, and my own path has been these periodic descents into me. Into
right.
myself.
Well, yeah. That's the spiritual path. It's inward in these levels, because in my teaching and the teachers that I've had, they say we're really here as incarnate beings to own the human experience, and you're not going to own anything by avoiding it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think the direction that you have led and had and help others with is really the dirty work of being human.
No, I agree. And, you know, in a lot of the work that I do, and particularly with this shadow work, you know, I hold myself out largely to people who've been walking the path for a while and who've been dealing with these issues. And many spiritual teachers don't really prepare us for this work. And so what happens is that when people start to do meditative practices or shamanic practices or the like, and they start to encounter these parts of themselves, they're confused, they're scared. Often they think they're not doing their practices correctly or not doing them, you know, hard enough or well enough. And but, you know, I'm here to say that really this is what spiritual practice is designed to bring us towards. And this is a sign that you're doing good work. And so, you know, I encourage people to, you know, when you hit those places in your spiritual journey, understand that a very valuable and potent door is opening for you.
Well, and also in order to teach us and help others, I mean, the work you do, you really have to go to all those places in yourself. I mean, you don't avoid them. I get the sense you jump in to it. You go for it if it comes up.
Yeah, you know, it's my intention in my own work to jump in. But, you know, I'm human, so I'm always discovering ways in which I'm running away. You know, I don't claim to be perfect at this, and you know, I want to say that off the bat, but it is my intention always to face these things, you know, in kind and gentle and compassionate ways.
I think just being there and holding the space or being a anchor of that reminder, I think that's what people need. I think that's a huge piece of what people need. And in a way, it's beyond any psychological therapy. It's a whole nother way of dealing with behaviors and actions.
Yeah, I think it includes everything that we know from psychology, but there's another dimension to it that makes it richer in a way. It's existentially deeper, and yet also kind of contains all the stuff that psychology knows. And psychology does, I do want to say that psychology does offer, offer some very valuable things, particularly in terms of how we create compassionate spaces inside of ourselves so that we can hold these experiences, because they are extremely, extremely difficult when we encounter them. And that's where my work comes in. I mean, my work comes in, I'm a space holder for people who are, willing to take the steps of going to these places. And being a space holder involves kind of, having some skills and knowing that there are skilled and kind of productive ways of inviting these experiences. And there are also ways that that can be, scarier than they have to be.
But, we still have been talking around it. I mean, can you really be, if you care to, really be specific in naming an example of a dark space in people or someone or yourself, if you care to, do you know what I mean? I want to hear these specifics if you don't mind, judgment or, I mean, you don't have to, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, it's interesting because what's dark, can be different for different people. The idea is somehow, what's forbidden. But for a lot of people, their darkness, for instance, is in anger and hatred.
I see.
So
if someone hated somebody and didn't want to admit that they really hated this person or disliked them and wanted to be light, that would be a dark place for them to go in and say, you know what? I don't like this person or something like that, right?
That would be an example of it, but I'm even thinking more an example of how this might manifest is if there's a hateful person you know and it really bothers you how hateful they are, and you start to do this work and you begin to touch upon the fact that this kind of burning hatred also exists inside of you. And it's not even necessarily directed at anybody that you know. It's not necessarily anything that you can recall from your life. It may not even be from this life. It may be really archetypal hatred. And we all have it. Every one of us has it. And so then, once a person encounters something like that, the question is, how do we invite that in ways that won't overwhelm us, won't freak us out? Because we have spent lifetimes, if you will, avoiding this.
So
there's
saying,
a lot of energy wrapped up in that.
Let me just kind of integrate that. So you're saying if I have someone in around me, or like a friend or a relative who's a hateful, angry person, and I have a lot of judgment about that type of person, I have to find that hateful place in myself that feels that will make me.
Yes. If something about the way somebody is in your life really pushes your buttons, my guess is that thing you're disliking, not even more than my guess, my assertion is that what you're not liking in that person is in you to be found.
And what if that person is just that? I mean, way. It's my reaction to that, you're saying? I mean,
it's your reaction that points the way. It doesn't actually say anything one way or another about what that person is or isn't.
So that person can remain hateful, but if I don't have a judgment about that, then I've accepted that part of myself as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can see a person who's like that, and for instance, your reaction could be one of compassion. Your reaction could be one of still maybe correcting the person's action, maybe stopping them from doing something harmful to somebody, and yet you're not being so emotionally triggered by what they're doing.
It
has to do with the felt sense of how that's causing you to react inside.
I know, I get it. When you said it, maybe it's one of compassion, because obviously someone who is that hateful is really in a lot of pain and is actually suffering, and this is a reaction to that suffering. So if I'm just reacting to the hateful part, then I have to see that maybe I'm doing that well, because then I'm responding exactly to that one person is. But you're saying with compassion, I start to see into the condition and realize, you know, in a sense, it's not our natural condition, but it's something, there's suffering in there in some ways.
There is suffering. And really, you know, if we want, okay, so if we limit ourselves to really a psychology, like, so that we're not getting so much into archetypes, but I mean, you know, really often what it is something very harmless that we did as a baby, as a small child. You know, we were taught that was wrong of us to be that way. And so we learn to kind of really dislike that aspect of ourselves, and we push it farther and farther away until we become unconscious of it. But then what happens is that when we see other people who are like that, we remember how much we mustn't ever be that way. And so there's an emotional trigger that gets us going, and that's what happens when people push our buttons, in a sense. So it's not the same thing as having a genuine, you know, indignation over, you know, some evil act that's happening and wanting to stop it and correct it. Because one could do that without getting, like, emotionally triggered, you know, and being thrown off their center.
So it's our emotional triggers that key us into the shadow parts of ourselves, is what you're saying.
Yes, I would say that that's absolutely correct. Now, what happens with spiritual practice, and that, of course, anybody can do that kind of shadow work, and there's lots of people who teach about that. Debbie Ford, who passed away recently, was very big on advocating shadow work, and a lot of what she taught was working with things like that.
I did a program with Debbie Ford, and I liked her. But I just want to comment that she was so out with her shadow that I think there was a shadow part of her shadow that was still there to be seen somehow. That's the sense I got from her, and I should have said that to her, but it came to me later. Do you know what I mean? If we're so out with our shadow, there's always a shadow somewhere. But if people are so visible with it, I think there's another deeper shadow in there.
Well, that's very possible. And what I wanted to say is that, you know, spiritual practitioners encounter their shadows in different ways, because when you're doing deep experiential practices, you have other access points to your shadow than looking at, like, what pushes your buttons in other people. Which is still there. I mean, you have that. That's always there. But when you're doing deep inner work, what's happening is you're actually coming face to face with these shadow elements. So you don't even have to look at what's pushing your buttons in other people. You're going to hit it in yourself as you're going deeper inside. And so that's really the kind of shadow work that I do is very experiential. And it's about learning to not, you know, it's learning to, I wanted to say it's learning to not push the shadow side away, but what I really encourage is a more accepting attitude, which means also, very importantly, accepting the part of ourselves that pushes that away. Mm-hmm. You know, we really have to hold it all. because all of these parts, you know, and what I wanted to say before is that whatever that big monster is that's inside of us, this horrible evil thing, usually turns out to be just a small thing that got blown out of proportion by the fact that it was made wrong for us, you know, often at a very early age.
Well, I was going to take the whole thing to another level, to more of, I love everything you're saying, and I think it's very, very important because it reorientates the spiritual awareness to the deep personal journey we're all on, and you know, it's not about what's out there, it's about what's in here and how much we accept ourselves. And if we take this to another level, to a global level, and we go back to this idea of evil and good and evil, there are companies and, you know, GMOs and oil companies and military industrial complex, and there's a lot of people doing not nice things for greed and power and money and you know, they're and destroying the planet. I mean, I don't want to have a judgment, but it seems like that's what's happening. And of course, mm-hmm. we're all participants in it because we all want our luxuries and our computers and all these things. So, what do we do with that? I mean, there's these huge things in the world that we're, you know, don't want to accept them for how they are, but we want to change them, but it's not nice.
Yeah. No, look, there's a lot of ugliness in the world. There's no question about it. And as I said before, I have so much respect for the people who are out there and fighting the good fight. What I want to say though is that, my take on it, like where I participate in this evolutionary, hopefully in this evolutionary movement, is that it's related to what I said before. Is, you know, I really, really, my experience is that we are all dreaming this world. So, you know, we talked about the impact of the shadow personally. But as I alluded to before, when you have 6 billion people, or maybe it's close to 7 billion now, I think, all of us unwilling to look at the darkness inside of us, then there's a mass projection. We're dreaming all these things we don't want to look at in ourselves, and we're creating the world with our dreams. So I think it's, you know, it's great that people are out there doing the things that they're doing to fight what's wrong with the world. And at the same time, the way I work with it is to try and hold my own darkness, to try and be awake in my dream so that it's not an unconscious process. The more awakeness I can bring to my own consciousness, to my own inner landscape, then the less I am contributing to this dream of the world that we're all creating. And the more I can help other people to do the same, I believe very strongly that what happens is, on a collective level, we can actually withdraw these projections. And a lot of this, I believe, will resolve. But that's a very high, tall order to do that level of inner work.
Well, but that's what we're here to do. I mean, right? I mean, isn't that why you've come? Isn't that the quest that you've set out for yourself to accomplish?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that is certainly what it's all about. But, you know, as you yourself said earlier, a lot of people don't like to look at this aspect of the spiritual journey. And so there's a lot of people that need to do this work. I guess that's
everybody. Everybody
needs to do it. And I think that you know, that's my calling. My calling is to kind of be, you know, call people to hey, everybody, let's find a way to embrace all that we are, so that how we are co-creating this world isn't coming from an unconscious dream, but rather from conscious intention. And I think when we start, the more we start to do this, the more the world can manifest in ways that I think we'll really see something beautiful.
Well, is there been a shift, would you say, or are people – something's happening. I think the internet, I mean, this intersection, because really all the internet is an intersection of consciousness. I mean, and information. I mean, it's a manifestation of our inner mind, and it's an amazing phenomena. But is the dream changing? And that's sort of what we'll be talking about next week on the panel. Is it changing, or is it the same old thing?
Yeah, you know, that's a wonderful, wonderful, deep question. And, you know, the very act of kind of contemplating that is, you know, there's really so much there. You know, my sense about it is, you know, I'm a big believer in archetypal energies. You know, I believe that there are archetypes. You know, there are psychic structures in the collective consciousness that are these universal patterns that have shown up in every period of our history, in every culture, you know, that has ever walked on our planet.
Well, like what? Can you specifically say what these things are?
Well, you know, some of the archetypes, you know, there are mother archetypes, there are father archetypes, there are teacher archetypes, but there are so many. You know, Jung initially developed the term archetype, and he talked about them, but there are so many more, I believe, than even he had thought of. And so I think in many ways, various archetypes can become stronger at different times in history. And so what I want to say is that these universal archetypes, I think, are ancient. They've always been around and always will be around. And I don't know that those are changing. I think that the details of how we tell the story, of how we create the story, are different because we live in a different culture in a different time, et cetera, right? I mean, Joseph Campbell talked about how various universal archetypes manifest in the myths of different cultures. But of course, the myths all sound different because, you know, all of the cultural artifacts of those cultures go into, you know, they dress the myths up according to the culture that they come from. But the archetypal stories that get told seem to get told over and over again. Now, one of the archetypes that I find really fascinating and I think are very, very prevalent in our culture now are the archetypes of death and rebirth and initiation.
Really? But those have always been the major archetypes in every culture and every religion around the world. Those have been the forces that it drove.
Well, yes, they have been important in every culture and every religion and spiritual tradition in the world. But I think that there are times in history that they become more dominant than other times. Just like, by the way, in our individual lives, there are times in our individual life, even though the death, rebirth, initiation archetype is always playing under the surface in our lives, but there are times in our lives when it becomes really big. So, you know, in tribal cultures, they tend to have rites of passage for people at times in their lives when particular death rebirth archetypes are happening, right? So when you hit adolescence, right, you have to die to being a child so that you can make a space for what it means to be an adult in your tribe.
Right. And right? That's what's missing in our culture, these rituals, although they exist on some ways, although, you know, having a bar mitzvah is a bit of a premature ritual for something about coming into the world, but, you know, or whatever other. I think weddings are beautiful rituals where you publicly declare your union. I think we do have that, and I think doing the ceremony, the ritual to mark a change impacts it more. It makes it more powerful, and we are missing some of that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that a lot of what we call rites of passage in our culture now, like bar mitzvahs and weddings, and I haven't done the research to back up what I'm about to say, but the sense I have is that these are watered down versions of something that they used to be, and that there used to be, you know, rites of passage. You know, they really are death rebirth experiences. You know, in tribal rites of passage, for instance, for adolescents, you know, the children are taken from their home. You know, they're prepared by elders, but then they're given some challenge, a challenge that's appropriate to the role that they'll have to take as adults. And these challenges are dangerous, and there are real elements of having to let go of the ways that these children have been up until then that won't serve them, for instance, as, I'll use boys as an example, as hunters, you know, in their tribe. And so, you know, I suspect, you know, I come from a Jewish background. I just suspect that my ancient ancestors' bar mitzvahs were very different from the experience that I went through when I was bar mitzvahed.
I think women, though, with their menstrual cycles, are maybe more in touch with an aspect of their womanhood. I guess men, too, in some ways. But I think those moments are inner significance of obvious transformations that
I agree with you. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not a woman and have never experienced this, but certainly this monthly cycle of death and rebirth that repeats itself, you know, over and over and over again, has to be a very profound experience. Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is having a ritual to honor a passage or rites of passage gives us something. I don't know what it gives us, but it gives us a sense of meaning, a purpose, it helps with a change. What does it give us in your understanding?
Well, I think an authentic rite of passage does more than just give meaning. I think it really is a death and a rebirth. I think that in a rite of passage, you have to let go of something that you're holding on to in yourself. You know, they're really, something does die inside in a real rite of passage. You know, our tribal ancestors couldn't survive if their rites of passage for adolescents were just about giving them senses of meaning in their lives. You know, they had to really take children and create warriors, you know, or they die.
Well, what can you translate that, though, to our culture? I mean, in a way, I would say graduating high school and going to college, that's a rites of passage in some sense. Going away to school, you know, just that, leaving home and you're somewhere else.
Yeah, I do think that we have them. I think that our culture doesn't necessarily own rites of passage as rites of passage, but clearly when young men and women leave home to go to college, that's a rite of passage. And in fact, you know, if you speak to many people of our generation, I'm a baby boomer, and many people in our generation will say that their college years were the most meaningful years of their lives. And really, because what was happening is that was a period of time when they were dying to their identities as children. And, you know, really, you get lost for a while. I can talk a little bit later about what the components of an initiation are. Yeah. But ultimately, you come out as something other than what you went in. I mean, really, really other than what – you know, in the generation before ours – it was for men. It was military service. Right. That was the real rite of passage. Right. In inner city neighborhoods, people joining gangs is actually a real. It's a rite of passage. It's unfortunately, you know, it's not an ideal rite of passage because it's not being facilitated in ways that are really for the good of the people going through the initiations. But it has the components of these archetypal initiations and death rebirth experiences.
Well, I guess fraternities would be sort of like that as well. You know, they do those initiations in a fraternity or in any kind of even spiritual communities. There's a sort of initiation. There can be. But I also think what you're saying is if, let's say, going away to college was more formally declared in a less secular culture as a rites of passage, I think people would be less lost. I mean, people are sort of, in hindsight, figuring that out for themselves. Oh, that was a rite of passage. I left high school, went away to college, and it's not signified as anything until years later. If it was mentioned as that, it would give us something more to move with, right? I mean,
yeah, I think that's right. And in fact, you know, I teach at universities, and I do think that if the administrators and professors who teach at our universities would embrace this idea of rite of passage a little bit more, I think that university experiences would be a whole lot richer and deeper and more beautiful and profound than even they are now.
Yeah. Do you do that in your classes? I mean, do you talk?
I actually do. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've been teaching at universities for longer than I've been, you know, doing this work with clients that I now do. And but it's my work, it's my spiritual work that really has changed the way that I deal with students. And so, you know, I really, when I teach a class, and interestingly, you know, in universities, I teach accounting. So it's about as far from something spiritual as you could probably imagine.
Oh, really? You don't teach a shamanic initiation in university?
I haven't, only secretly. I haven't found a university that has that class yet. But it doesn't matter because, you know, I'm teaching accounting students, and the truth is these are young men and women who are preparing themselves for a life that they know nothing about before they come into it. So when you're preparing someone for a career in that way, you know, in many ways these archetypes of death and rebirth have to play into how you educate them. Because, you know, people come in with ideas about things and they think about things in certain ways that aren't really going to serve them in their new life. Both in an intellectual sense in terms of their understanding of the subject matter, but even in a sense of how they think of themselves. So, you know, not only do I teach accountants to be accountants in a technical sense, but also how to be the accountants in a professional sense. And so you have to, you know, these are students who are, you know, range from 19 to 22 years old for the most part. I do get some older students, but, you know, they have to let go of really being high school students, you know, and by the time they come out of a program, right, they're ready to join a profession, you know, a society of professionals that actually has a very important role in the world. And so they have to really be ready to hold that. And so my classes with them have a lot of this death rebirth because what I have to do is I have to challenge them in their beliefs very often.
And do you do that in an accounting situation?
I absolutely do. And the other thing that I want to say, though, which is extremely important because, you know, one of the things about rites of passage and the reason that I mentioned that professors, I'd like to see them embrace this role more, is that the ritual elder is so important in a rite of passage. Because the ritual elders create the container that make it safe for people to let go and allow themselves to die to what they were. And so my students in my classes, it's very interesting because they know they're being challenged. I make them extremely uncomfortable. But before I do, they learn that I am their absolute 100% supporter, that I am there rooting them on to victory. I have no desire to see them fail, even though there's a real possibility they will fail. They know they have my full support. And so I'm building that container throughout a semester with my students. And then at some point, you know, roughly two-thirds of the way through the semester is when I will, you know, present the challenge that will kind of make these students feel like the rug's been pulled out from under them.
Wait, what do you mean? What would that be, that challenge?
Well, it really depends on the class that I'm taking. And you know, without getting into, you know, because you know, I don't want to start getting into the technicalities of accounting. But often what I'll do, for instance, you know, especially in a subject like accounting, students do a lot of memorizing in their early classes. They kind of learn accounting by rote. They memorize rules and they learn to apply them. And so what I, you know, what I do, because I often teach more advanced students, that's what I like to do, is I will teach the most difficult subject for the semester in a way that's totally different from the way their textbook teaches it, so that they can't rely on the same security blanket that they've had the whole time that they've been learning. And that's really hard. And what I end up doing is I get them to think about things that they learned in their very first accounting class, but in completely different ways from any way that they've ever had to before. And they don't have answers in front of them to memorize, and it makes them really uncomfortable. But they also know that I'm there supporting them, and they get through it. And it's a meaningful experience for them. They feel like they've really accomplished something.
Well, that's important, but I'm just curious, do you feel some kind of dilemma maybe that you are training people for a role in society, and this is just my judgment, that cuts them off from the rest of their totality as being an accountant? Not that it has to, but that's just how I see it. I mean, is there some conflict in you about that?
There used to be, but there isn't anymore, because I no longer think that way about the profession. I think that we live in a complex world, and there are places for you know, all kinds of roles that people can assume. And the truth is, you know, we're going to have commerce in our society. You know, we trade. You know, this is how we take care of ourselves materially. And accountants are actually responsible for the integrity of the financial system. You know, it doesn't always work, but that's their role. It's actually a very noble role. Right. And so, you know, and you know, I treat my students as full human beings, and they understand that. I mean, they can look at me, because they can look at me and they know I'm not their typical accounting professor.
Right.
You know, I'm very different from all the rest of them. And that gives them permission to be that way. I think a person can do any type of work and still be evolving spiritually and consciously.
Right. And I think that's a really important point, and it's a good point to remind me of. I mean, because, like, I'm, you know, thinking it has to be a certain way, but it, the fact that you acknowledge them as full human beings and the fact that they are contributing in a healthy way to a society that's unfolding, and you're training them to be full human beings in that society, will only, I think, have beneficial effects on the roles they then take in the world.
So. Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Well, so I really believe there's nobility in everything. I mean, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, you know, I mean, in the Bhagavad Gita, that's the whole punchline of the Bhagavad Gita. It's like, you know, Arjuna, who was Krishna was reciting the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, and Arjuna was a warrior. And the whole story of the Bhagavad Gita was Arjuna sat down in despair in the middle of the battlefield and said, "What am I doing here? You know, killing people. This is the most unspiritual thing I can think of." And Krishna set him straight and said, "You're just not thinking the right way." You know, and he said, you know, basically, it's you know, the totality, this totality of who we are includes all of this. And we all have this role, and the key is learning to dance in our roles in a conscious way.
Right, right. So I get that, and I think it's great that you're doing it the way you're doing it. It is surprising, and it's amazing. But let's break it down just a little bit, and you talked about aspects of initiation. So what would these how do you do, you know what the interesting thing about initiation? You say the word backwards. I was playing it on a video, and it sounds like initiation. Backwards and forwards, it's initiation.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful thing, and there's been a lot of work done that kind of like look at the various stages of initiation. For instance, if you look at the work of Joseph Campbell, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey really contains all of the stages of an initiatory process. So it's really interesting. I highly recommend, everybody who is on a spiritual path should read Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. It's to me, it's a must-read book. But he's not the only one by any stretch of the imagination to do this. Mircea Eliade, who was a great
his professors, right? Didn't he get a lot from Mircea?
I don't know whether Campbell studied with him or not, but he also described the initiation process in a similar way. Victor Turner was another scholar who really described initiatory processes. But basically, the initiatory process basically is like this. You start with your life as it is. And so, this is just kind of this is Victor Turner called this structure. It's profane space, if you will. And at some point, you realize something's not working in that world anymore. Right? So this is the call. You're being called now to adventure, which is the way that Campbell talked about it, the call to adventure. And what happens is you're pulled out of this comfortable life. And all of a sudden, you're in this very difficult place. Mm-hmm. And all the structures that you've come to know and love, the structures that have helped you and served you, have been right for you up until this point in your life, just aren't anymore. And it feels horrible. This is like death. This feels like death. And we fight it the way any dying person would fight dying. It's almost biological human nature to fight death. You can see it in animals. It's not just a human thing, right? We fight to live. So part of the initiatory process for a ritual elder is to hold the space while someone is wrestling with death and gradually letting go. So there's this sense of you're taken from this familiar, comfortable, idyllic place. You're put in this horribly uncomfortable and unfamiliar situation, which has challenges, right? And which has a real chance of not surviving. And then at some point, you're really thrown into it. You really hit death. They call this the liminal phase, L-I-M-I-N-A-L. Liminal is from the same root as threshold. Liminal means threshold. And so this is a place where we're no longer what we used to be, but we're not yet what we're going to become. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a clue what that's going to be. So we are completely in between. This is betwixt and between. And it's a totally non-ordinary state of consciousness. And it can last a while. It can be really difficult. It can be really difficult. And then gradually you start to build a new life. It starts to come to you what you're becoming. And at that point, you start to come back out into a structured life again. You know, you can think of it psychologically as you had a persona, and then your persona wasn't working anymore, and the archetypal theme that's taking place is you need to shed it, but of course you fight that process. So there's a lot of struggle. Eventually it just, it goes. You have to let it go and you die, metaphorically. And then gradually you're reborn and a new persona is built that serves you better in your new life, whatever that's going to be. And then of course there's a lot of rich details that Campbell fills in, you know, things like, you know, magical boons that come to you that help you in your journey, helpers and things like that. And it's interesting too that the scholars of initiation have talked about pathologies of initiation, ways in which initiatory processes can fail. And so I'll talk about a couple. One Campbell talked about directly, and that was refusing the call. So you get the call, and you just don't listen, and you don't listen, and you don't listen.
Well, how do we recognize the call as a call? How do you know?
Well, okay, so that's – now that's – okay, so my opinion is that's really tricky for us as Westerners. Because if you come from a culture that kind of is more in tune with the natural rhythm of initiations, deaths, and rebirths, then you have elders in your tribe who can basically, you know, there are tribal myths that help you to recognize these things, and there are elders who can point it out. And so what happens is all you know is that my life's not working anymore. And so, right, not all these things that used to work just aren't working. You know, this is uncomfortable. Sometimes you lose a job, you know, or someone dear to you leaves or dies. It could be physical illness that leads to this, right? It could be, you know, I think I said losing a job already. You know, failing at something. That's extremely meaningful to you. Failure is a huge initiator of these processes.
Mm-hmm. And so what do we do with all that? Okay, we get a call, but we don't know where to go, what to do, right? I mean,
yeah. Now this is where our culture, you know, really has its problems, because we don't really have elders. You know, if you were in a tribal culture, I mean, first of all, certain initiatory processes, they just have scheduled into your life. Like adolescence, you're going to be taken away from the tribe. You're going to go through one of these initiations and then returned differently from the way you left. You know, and they would have these in adolescence. They'd have it in young adulthood. They have it in midlife. They have it at retirement. They have it as you're getting ready to actually physically leave your body, right? All of these. And these are still, you know, these callings exist in our world. You know, I know so many elderly people now, people of my parents' generation who are, you know, in their 90s, and how they're fighting the inevitable. Right. Rather than, and there's nobody to help them through it. This is a time for initiation. This is a time for somebody to hold the space so that they can let go of all these old definitions and these old ways of being that were perfectly fine when they were younger. Right. But now they have to be getting ready for a different role as they're approaching their final years. So, in, you know, our culture doesn't have the elders, and that is a very tough thing. Because it means that, for the most part, we have to navigate these initiations ourselves.
Mm-hmm. One thing you said, failure can be an initiation. Can success be that too, in a way? I mean, or not in the same way?
Success, you know, to hear the call, you have to hear that there's something not right.
Mm-hmm.
So if through being extremely successful at something, you have this gnawing feeling that something's not right, then success could be a calling. But I think it's harder to see that, you know, because you're celebrating like, yeah, everything came out the way I wanted it to.
So you feel whatever it is, something's not right, And then, of course, if you had a guidance or elder, they would tell you then go into the forest and meditate. Or, I mean, what do we do? I understand what it could have been, but what do we do now? I mean, maybe we seek some people out, and there are more and more spiritual teachers available for this. So,
yeah.
So how do we go through this whole process?
Yeah, so you first of all, you want to know who those spiritual teachers are, and not every spiritual teacher is good for this sort of thing. Because again, this is somebody who is willing to hold space through your death rebirth experience. And death rebirth, you know, deaths are ugly. You know, they're not easy. They're very difficult. So you need someone who really can make a big space of acceptance for you to go through whatever this process is. You know, this is what I attempt to do in working with my clients. Now I'm a substitute for, a whole group of tribal elders that one might have in a tribe, right? I mean, I'm one person. And frankly, I can't do one of the key things that the tribal elders would do, which is remove the initiate from their normal responsibilities of their lives. You know, when you go through an initiatory period in a tribe, you're told, okay, you don't have to work in the fields or go on the hunts anymore, right? You're removed from that. You're actually, in fact, you're often considered outcast in your village, in your tribe. So you're removed from it completely physically. And the elders are holding space. And then there's some kind of challenge. The challenge could be internal. The challenge could be external, depending on the tribe and the type of initiation. But that's what happens. And then it's going to last some period of time, from days to weeks, maybe sometimes months, but they usually don't drag on. I was talking about some of the pathologies of initiation, and another is a phenomenon that's called chronic liminality. And chronic liminality means becoming addicted to the liminal state, becoming addicted to that betwixt and between non-ordinary state of consciousness.
Well, you know,
don't want to come back.
Well, I just want to say that's an interesting point, because it seems like a lot of the baby boom generation, the hippies, they have been on the rainbow path too long, and they sort of get stuck in that, not quite drugged out state, but, smoking marijuana, doing those things. And that's the liminal state that has they've heard the call, but they've stayed in the woods, back to the world.
Yeah, I think it's a very common phenomenon. And I think, a big important role of the ritual elder is to make sure that the initiate comes through, past the liminal state into the new life that they're going to live. It's an extremely important part of the process. And I think when we don't have that kind of guidance from elders, it's very easy, because, what happens is these liminal states start to have meaning for us in ways that our old lives didn't. So we're like, wow, this is great. Why would I ever want to be anything else? But it really is just an intermediate step. And actually what awaits on the other side is far greater. So, I'm not quick to judge people who get caught in chronic liminality. I think it's actually to be expected when you have, unfacilitated initiations. One of the specialties of my work is I work with a phenomenon that's called spiritual emergency. And spiritual emergency happens when our spiritual evolution becomes destabilizing in our lives. But the truth is, spiritual emergency is really, it is an initiatory process that has not been facilitated and allowed to proceed in a good way.
So the idea of there are levels and levels of initiation. Some people say that the whole teaching of Jesus was to bring through levels or to demonstrate different levels of initiation.
In fact, I would say that the life of Jesus is actually a parable of initiation, and more to the point, the death and rebirth of Jesus.
Right. Right.
If you really look at what they call the Passion of Christ and Christ on the cross and the suffering and then finally the death and then there's a resurrection. And what's interesting is, you know, Christian teaching talks a lot about, you know, the passion and the suffering and the dying, and it talks a lot about the resurrection. And the thing that's the real secret is who was Jesus in those 3 days between the time that he was crucified and the time he came back?
You mean that's the liminal state you're saying?
That's the liminal state right there.
That's where the caterpillar's body completely melts.
Yeah.
And so that liminal state is where, or do you need to even teach, or does the teacher let the student go completely at that and say, find your own way, or is the teacher there guiding that person? I mean, how does that work? I'm just curious.
Well, it's, you know, I think it's, well, okay, it's not an either or, I don't think. You know, I think that the teacher has to stand by a lot and let the process unfold, but the teacher also is always right there on the outskirts so that the initiate is never far from the elder. The elder really is holding the space in a very important way.
And if the initiate knows that, that does what? Gives them more courage? I mean,
I think it helps in the letting go process. Like, cause you know, the part on the cross, if you will, to keep the Christian analogy going, the part on the cross, you know, involves surrender. Mm-hmm. And it's harder to surrender. Yeah, it's easy. I'll say it differently. It's easier to surrender when you know that you have these elders in your corner and supporting you and holding the space and reassuring you that your ancestors have taken the same path and not, you know, not giving you any illusions that it's easy, because deaths never are. But also, you know, giving you the assurance that even though we may not know what we'll be when we come out the other side, we know that whatever we're going to be is going to be so much better and so much more true to what we need to become.
Is there's always a resurrection or a rebirth. I mean, this is what I guess people don't realize if you just focus on the death. There is the rebirth. That's part of the natural cycle.
If the initiation is allowed to complete, there's always the rebirth. But obviously, if you get caught in refusal of the call or you know, chronic liminality, right, you cannot see, you know, it's possible to not see the initiation through to its conclusion, in which case the rebirth doesn't happen. Now, what I want to say is the archetype of initiation is a persistent little bugger, which means that if you don't finish your initiations, you know, it's going to keep knocking at your door.
Right,
because it's almost biological, you know. It really wants to happen. And the other thing I want to say is that's really important, because it's that even if your initiation successfully completes, you know, please know, don't fool yourself into thinking you'll never have to go through this process again. This archetype of initiation is there throughout our lives. And it's there to make us whole, and it does it in a kind of cyclical way. So there's always more initiations to go through.
Mm-hmm. What are they changing? I mean, in this new culture that's evolving, are those initiations different than they were before?
Well, I think one of the biggest triggers of initiation now is actually trauma.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think that a lot of in our culture, a lot of the initiations will be more individual as opposed to group, and will be less tied to the seasons of our lives, because frankly, our lives in general are less tied to the seasons of our lives. And so I think that – but trauma is something that we all experience in one way or another.
Well, what do you mean by trauma? How, like, what is trauma? What does that mean?
Well, trauma is, I mean, many things can be traumatic. You know, so, you know, obvious things that everybody thinks of when they think of trauma is when you experience some kind of catastrophe, like people who were in Boston for the bombing and
9/11,
either.
And
so either they were hurt badly themselves or witnessed other people, you know, suffering in horrible ways and seeing dismemberments or you know, death around you. People who go to war, you know, frequently experience trauma. Those are the obvious cases. But, you know, we also know that, you know, that young children are extremely susceptible to trauma. And so that – and you know – something as simple as the innocent act of a parent not responding to a child crying immediately could end up being traumatic for that child. And it's part of development. That's why I say, you know, we all have that. And part of our spiritual work, part of that shadow work that we started out talking about is kind of revisiting these old traumas. And of course you want to do that in skillful ways. Because in fact, those old traumas are the ones that are the most deeply buried and often have, you know, the strongest impact on us. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just saying, for people who experience trauma, it seems like those memories, that history is lodged in a way forever inside somebody and doesn't act as initiation, but acts as a shadow, as we talked about before.
Well, I think that I'm going to say, and I hope this isn't too controversial, but what we think of as post-traumatic stress, right, which is the symptoms that we have from these unhealed traumas, you know, I view that as a calling. That's what calls us to initiation. The initiation is going to take us into what couldn't be felt at one time and needs to be felt. And of course that I want to really be careful in saying that needs to be done, you know, in careful and skilled ways. But that actually healing trauma is a huge initiation. It is a huge initiation. And the post-traumatic stress is the calling. I also want to say that, and this was a big thing from, you know, one of my primary teachers is Stanislav Grof, and he talked a lot about the birth trauma and how traumatic the birth process is, and he describes it in great detail based on his experiences in non-ordinary states of consciousness, but not only his own, but actually facilitating journeys of thousands and thousands of people over 40 years of time, and he found that birth trauma is very, very prevalent in people. And without going into too much detail, because I know we're running over, but
it's okay. We have time.
You know,
we can talk.
Grof's description of the birth process is remarkably similar to Campbell's description of the hero's journey.
But what do you do with trauma? Let's say you've been traumatized. You did witness something. You did experience something. How do you go on that calling and extricate it and make yourself whole from that?
Well, the question you ask is, you know, it's a big one. And I think that we as a culture, even people who don't think in terms of things like archetypes and rites of passage and initiations, right, how we heal trauma is a very hot topic in psychology. It's important because trauma is, in fact, becoming more and more pervasive, and you know, in our culture. If I can speak in just the most general terms, because there are many, many ways of working with trauma, and I think many of them are really, really good ways to work in an initiation. And I think that, first of all, as I said, initiations require elders. And so, you know, I'll take it down to if your initiation is about trauma, you need an elder, whether that elder is a therapist or whether it is a shaman. But it should be someone who has experience working with these things. And, and they're there to, you know, help you process it. And because, you know, healing from trauma is going into the shadow. It is in a very real way going into the shadows. And to really do effective shadow work and effective trauma work, you have to have a good elder or elders who are holding the space in skillful, loving, and compassionate ways. There has to be a sense of safety.
Right. I mean, it's interesting what you say, that trauma is, in a sense, the new initiation. But I think as a planet or a global culture, we are facing interesting times. I mean, not to get too far off the subject, but I was just in Washington at the citizens' hearings for UFO disclosure. Mm-hmm. And whether or not these beings exist, let's say they do, the contact with the other, it will be traumatic for our culture. And how would we as a global society face an initiation like that? I mean, I know I'm just throwing this out there in a almost science fiction way, but do you know what I'm asking? If we take that as an example, cultures have faced, you know, the Native Americans faced a culture that they were unprepared for. But anyway, something like that.
The experiences of alien abductions, actually, you know, among the phenomenon that we work with when we work with people in spiritual emergency, you know, one of the big ones is when people have been, you know, have experienced abductions, alien abductions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's their calling, by the way. You know, when we work with people like that, and I don't have personal experience with abduction cases, but I know of them. Mm-hmm. But you work with them the way you would with almost any other spiritual emergency, which is that, you know, what you do is you open the door for people to safely reenter those experiences. Because they are traumatic for the people who experience them. They are absolutely traumatic.
They are. I think I've had one myself. But how do we do that? I'm just saying, as a global culture, how do we meet the other? And let's say it's a form of the alien or even spiritual beings, but let's say it's the alien. How do we meet the other and face which is, in a sense, the facing the shadow, because the other is always the shadow part of ourselves, and mm-hmm. and go through that initiation out the other side so we expand as a civilization? I mean, that's sort of a question I've just been thinking about for the last couple of years.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful question. It really is. And I would even at this point leave behind the detail of whether we're talking about, you know, acceptance of aliens as opposed to, and make the question more general, which is how do we facilitate collective initiation? You know, and in fact, our discussion here together started by my saying that I think that these archetypes of death, rebirth, and initiation are very prominent in our culture right now. And then we went on to talk about them in an individual sort of way. But I actually do think that collectively, these same archetypes, I think that there are a lot of these things that are troubling in our world. I mean, you turn on the news any day of the week, you know, and there's just so much going on that's potentially very troubling. And this is the calling, you know. I really do think that we're very much in, in one of these transits, if you will, of death, rebirth, and initiation. I think the phenomenon of 2012 was in fact very much about a collective death, rebirth, initiation, that more or less accurately, you know, centered around that date. And the issue of how, you know, I can talk about and have talked some about some of the principles of how we facilitate individuals going through death, rebirth, initiations. But, wow, how do you hold space for a culture when, in fact, you're part of it?
Right. That's the question, really, I think.
Yeah, it's a big question.
What would you say? I mean, I'm not saying you have to have the right answer. I'm just curious what you would because in a sense, because we've become a global planet and we've become, in a way, one civilization, it's new territory for us as a global civilization to move in. We don't have to even call it aliens, but to a new place in encountering ourselves as a collective population of one psyche.
Yeah, I hear you. I think there's a few things come to mind. I think the first is for us to remember that this is what's going on. And that means remembering that there is a death aspect of it and that there's a rebirth aspect of it. So in other words, that this is a natural process that's happening to us. It's happening with a trajectory that we can't know ahead of time. I think that's a really important thing to emphasize is we can't get too visionary about where we're going, because the truth is we're dying. And when you're in a death part of a death rebirth process, you cannot know what the other side of it is going to be like.
Except civilization is dying. No, I just wanted to...
Or some aspect of it is dying. I'm not necessarily claiming that civilization is dying.
No, you're not.
Some important aspect of how the civilization operates, its underlying assumptions, the way it feels, right? Yeah. Something is shifting. Well, and that shift is destabilizing.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And I said this at a talk. I said that medicine is in the way of health. Religion is in the way of spirituality. Government's in the way of freedom. All these institutions we constructed to help us and to benefit us are now in the way of our own progress. And this is the place we're in as a collective. And those places are crumbling and being...
Yeah.
Born. So,
and they have to. And so, you know, what I want to say is, you know, these are structures, right? We created these structures to serve us, and they did serve us, you know, in good ways for as long as they needed to. Now we're in a period when our needs are changing, but the structures are very stuck, right? We're rigidly caught in the structures. And so that's what we're feeling now, is that friction. And that's natural. That is what's supposed to be happening. And it's a natural, but it's a painful process. And you talked about how do we facilitate this. The first thing I'd say is remember the whole process. Remember this is what's going on. Also, I think it's really important to remember that there's mystery here. We can't pretend to know what's going on. We have to always be in awe of the mystery. I think that's so important. I think on the death side of a death rebirth process, we have to remember compassion. We have to remember that this is painful for people, that there's real suffering going on, and that even though collectively there's going to be something better on the other side of this, we must never lose the compassion for the people suffering. I've seen some people who, you know, have been very big advocates of 2012 and things like that, who almost seem to rejoice every time there's another catastrophe that was showing, you know, see, we're definitely in this process. And you know what? I wish I could make it go away, you know,
right.
Because it's painful. And you know, I never want to see suffering in the world. So I think that's another important part.
Well, it's interesting you say you never want to see suffering, but your work, in a way, is to see suffering, you know.
I tell this to my clients all the time. I say, you know what, if I had a magic wand and could make it so that you never had to experience the suffering, I'd do it in a second.
But then they wouldn't see their shadow. I'm not saying suffering.
Well, what I'm saying is the magic wand would allow them to get whatever the benefit of the shadow work is without the painful part. That's what we all want. You know, there's an expression, and I heard this on a political news show once, but it really applies, which the expression was something like, everybody wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die. And You know, so what I'm saying is if I could get you to heaven without dying, I would love to do it.
No, but I don't know about that. But the suffering, there's something in – I'm not saying suffering's good, but in going through the pain, that's where the medicine is, isn't it, in somewhere? And that, I mean,
yes. I mean,
isn't that
yes.
key?
It, of course, is key.
In so, initiation, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not saying. I mean, you're absolutely right. The medicine is in the suffering. It's necessary. It has to happen. But what I'm saying is, my heart says, I wish it could happen without this, because I never want to be desensitized to the suffering
right.
of another human being.
Right. And I don't think
that's
would.
Really all I was saying. Yeah. And you know, the other thing that I think is important for facilitating this collective initiation, I think, and this is also goes back to what we started talking about at the beginning of our discussion, is if we can facilitate our own individual, you know, really allow our own individual death rebirth processes, you know, willingly step into that shadow work, willingly own who we are. I think that's a prerequisite to being able to hold a space for the collective. Because if I'm working with individuals going through these transitions, the most important quality that I can have is to be able to hold their experience, no matter how scary or sloppy or messy it is. And of course, when someone goes through these experiences, it pushes our buttons. You know, when you see somebody go through this, I mean, you know, I could start a whole other show on this, but I mean, why have we traditionally, you know, treated the mentally ill in ways that basically the only message we give them is, I don't want to ever see your symptoms. Well, we don't want to see their symptoms because they remind us of what we're afraid of in ourselves. And, you know, so we have to do the work on ourselves. We cannot hold the space for a culture if we haven't visited our dark places, because what's going to happen is, as the culture goes into dark places or exiled places, because as I said at the beginning, there are light places that are exiled too. But as the culture moves to those exiled places, we have to be careful and be able to watch how they trigger us, because we will not be able to hold space if we're reacting.
Right. No, I think it's interesting. But what you said before is, we can't know how it's going to come out, and that's part of it, is going into the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's where we are now. Everybody knows the culture's changing, it's shifting. We don't know what that's going to become.
No, so, we don't, and we have, and really we have to be comfortable with that uncertainty. We have to be able to sit and hold the fact, right? Because we all want to know. That's human nature, right? We want to have a new structure to hold on to. And right now, the old structures are crumbling, and we don't have the new ones, and we have to be able to be comfortable with that. And that's where that individual inner work happens, because when you do the inner work, you start to get comfortable with uncertainty inside yourself. And as you can do it in your personal process, you'll be able to do it more in the collective process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand. So there's like two things. There's a map for initiation, death, rebirth, all that. There's that that's innate to, in a way, the archetypal senses of who we are. And then there's the journey into the unknown, where maybe that map doesn't apply somehow. I mean, it's being restructured, even all that. I mean,
maybe.
Well, there's no elders.
I mean, it's possible, but I mean that the unknown is part of the map.
I see. Yeah.
You know what I mean? The existence of the unknown is included in the map. I mean, the map tells us that, you know, when you're in the death part and in the liminal part, you don't know what you're being reborn into. You just don't.
Right.
And so the map is telling you that.
Right. But I guess that's where trust, and you keep going forward. You don't, when the people stay in the liminal stuff, it's like the plays of Shakespeare, you know, the comedies where the hero goes into the forest and comes out the other end and is reborn and all that. You know, in As You Like It, you know, you have to come out of the forest in order to come back into the world, the workaday world, you know, to.
Very well said. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And Shakespeare was brilliant in, you know, in those comedies, As You Like It, What You Will, they were all comments on this sort of, transformation of everyday life into being reborn into something greater than we were before we went on the journey.
Yeah, no, so. I agree. Shakespeare was great for that. Greek mythology. The Lord of the Rings is a wonderful allegory of the death, rebirth, initiation process and the hero's journey. And you know, if you read The Lord of the Rings, you know, the whole last section is about, you know, the hobbits' lives when they return to their ordinary life at the Shire, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, they're getting married and they're, you know, they're going back to their work in the world, you know, but having been changed in this way.
But,
you know,
I think it's great. And I think films in general give us maps of the journey. I just think perhaps there's a new map and a new journey and a new unknown that may not have an archetypal structure we can refer to yet, because I think we're going into new places, new civilizations, all that. And I think it's just my sense, collectively the unknown is forming itself in new ways that are wondrous and surprising and exciting as well.
Mm-hmm. It certainly could be. You know, I generally have held the opinion that, you know, the archetypes are the archetypes, and they'll take new forms, and they'll be forms we've never seen before, but they still are kind of the universal archetypes. But you know what? As I said before, if we're going to sit through an initiation like this, we have to be open to the unknown and the wonder and the possibilities of exactly what you're talking about, which is experiencing things that have never been before. And so, you know, I want to embrace that with you, that is a possibility.
It's a possibility. I just think it's always nice to include that, whether or not it's true or even possible. I don't know. But thank you. I mean, for just being aware or staying open to that possibility, because there's so much we don't know, and I don't think we know the structures of human thought either. I mean, I think something's happening on our planet that seems like it hasn't happened before.
And I think there's way more we don't know than there is we do know.
Right. So hopefully we'll pick up that conversation next week at the Meta Center.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it very much.
But is there anything else that you – I mean, we hit a lot of places and I think a lot of important points of your teaching in showing people what our natural state is as archetypal beings and how we can function within that and how that can lead us. I think that's important to cover, and we did cover
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
I think if there's one more thing that I would like to say to each and every person who's listening is stay open to what's happening in your life. Don't assume that you know where you're going. Be open to the mystery and the wonder. And when you encounter places that are difficult and stormy and uncomfortable, first of all, remember to be kind to yourself, to love yourself, to be compassionate with yourself, and seek support from skilled elders when you need it. Don't feel that you have to go through these alone, because really no civilization in history has ever assumed that initiates travel this path entirely on their own. There are always times that we seek the help of elders. And so seek them out when it's time, and always remember to really be gentle and compassionate with yourself, because we are all moving towards wholeness. We're all moving towards our greater evolution and beauty and fulfillment of our destiny.
And the destiny, in a way, is unknown, isn't it?
It is unknown. It is unknown, but I have faith that that when we find it, and of course these are intermediate steps, right? So it's like when we find the next one, that next one is going to fit us so much better than anything we've worn before.
Mm. And that, yeah, I think so. I mean, that next phase, as we move through one level of initiation, and I guess that's what's happening planetarily, the next phase is so much more wonderful and mysterious and exciting than where we've been.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think yeah. That's the purpose of initiation, in a sense, is to give us a greater sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so let's remember that, because it's not easy. It's right. Not easy. And so we need to remember the goal while at the same time, you know, being open and holding, you know, all the stuff that comes along the way.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you're out there and at least you have the map, you know, because so many people think they are doing it on their own or have to do it on their own, and you're there. And you're helping people, so I'm glad you're doing that. So, thank you.
It's very gratifying work, and I have to say though that, you know, when I'm really with my clients, I throw away the map as often as I use it. So because the details are where the work is,
right?
And the nitty gritty details don't show up on the map. Only the kind of the larger outline is on the map,
right. But holding space for someone is important, and I want to say Kevin does do shamanic counseling sessions in New York. He's a certified holographic breath worker with the
holotropic breath work.
Holotropic,
yeah.
Right? Holotropic.
Mm-hmm.
You do Skype sessions. You do spiritual counseling. Or you just do shamanic practices as well, and you teach accounting. So there you go.
Yeah, and I also work with a wonderful method called focusing, which is it's a very gentle way of working with these processes, because it helps us get in touch with our bodily felt experience of the present moment and where we are in it, and there's so much that's contained in that felt experience. It's like a jewel that we carry around all the time and don't pay attention to. And focusing is a way of attending to it.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for being a guest here. Again, Kevin will be on the upcoming panel on the new myths of the digital age and the evolution of consciousness at the Meta Center May 16th. That's Thursday, May 16th. And you can find out more about that if you go to my website, newrealities.com. Your email, should I give it out to people if they want to reach it?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, please.
safejourneyshome@gmail.com. That's for Kevin Sachs and his all the things we've talked about tonight, and going into specifically those areas that you might want to avoid, you know, those shadow parts, but the ones that are there for transformation. And thanks again, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was really an honor to be here and to talk about these things and to be traveling the path with you and with everybody else who's listening, because we're all in this together, and we're all here to evolve ourselves, but also be supports for one another.
Right. I think that's the best. I think that's a functional society, and if we do that, and we do that collectively, we create new realities, new planets, a new civilization. So, onward into the unknown.
Absolutely.
Thanks. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, you can go to my website, newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening, everybody out there. Good night. Thank you, Jean Marie. And I'll talk to everybody soon. Good night.